Lecture 17, Xuanzang and Chinese Buddhism.
Hello again. With this lecture, we're going to complete what's traditionally referred to as the three teachings of China, Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism. We've already discussed the origins of Buddhism and its later division into two major movements. There was the Theravada school, the school of the elders, and then Mahayana, the great vehicle. Mahayana itself developed into competing schools, including the Madhyamaka school, the school of the middle way of Nagarjuna in the 2nd century, and the Yogacara school, remember that's consciousness only, that Vasubandhu developed in the 4th century. And then there were lots of other schools. The story from India is already complicated when it gets to China, and there it gets even more confusing. There are dozens of schools and scriptures and major figures. In this lecture, I'll provide an overview of how Buddhism became widely accepted in China with a few sketches of some key thinkers, and especially a monk named Xuanzang. But we'll start with the big picture. Buddhism was first introduced into China in the 1st century AD. In the beginning, though, it didn't attract a lot of attention. It was mostly a religion for foreign merchants who were living in China. It became very popular, however, after the collapse of the Han Dynasty in 220 AD. As we saw in the last lecture, that was a time when a lot of people were looking for new answers. In some ways, the success of Buddhism is surprising. There were many cultural obstacles. There were suspicions about its foreign origins, right? Confucius never talked about Buddhism. It's not mentioned in the Confucian classics. The fact that monks and nuns abandoned their political and family obligations, that they didn't pay taxes, that monks weren't conscripted into the army, they didn't give labor service, which was an important part of the taxation burden on peasants. Monks and nuns don't do ancestor worship, so there's a concern about filial piety. And some people said, well, perhaps by their self-sacrifice, they can earn merit that they can then transfer to their parents. There were also problems with translations and a lot of competing schools that just kept everyone guessing. But Buddhism does succeed in China, kind of amazingly. By the middle of the 6th century, it's reported that there were some 2 million Buddhists in China and 30,000 monasteries. Okay, so now another list about what went right for Buddhism. First, it came in a time of political turmoil. Do you remember the chaos and warfare after the fall of the Han Dynasty? So when Buddhist missionaries knocked on people's doors, just sort of imagine this analogy, and said, we have a message for you. Our message is the first noble truth, all life is suffering. Some Chinese people said, wow, that's what I've always thought about my life. So there's an openness to new ideas. Confucianism had been discredited with the fall of the Han Dynasty and its close association with the imperial rule. And now there came new rulers into China, oftentimes nomadic peoples who invaded China and then settled down there. And some of their kings were very interested in Buddhism, partly because these are non-Chinese rulers and Buddhism was a non-Chinese religion. And it stressed sort of the universality of human beings. Some of those rulers also claimed to be bodhisattvas. Some Chinese people like the ethical standards of Buddhism, as opposed to, say, the flaunting of conventional morality that we saw in the six sages of the bamboo grove. And then there were parallels with Taoism in terms of the kinds of questions they ask and the way they spoke about things. And there are new forms of philosophy and art that come from India. So for the first time in China, we see giant statues and cave temples. And there are new ideas of the afterlife, very specific ideas of heavens and hells. And there are miracles that are done by Buddhist monks and by missionaries. Let's talk a little bit more about the Taoist connections. There are always considerable difficulties when a religion or a philosophy crosses cultural barriers. And in China, the first bridges for Buddhism were laid by Taoists. So they were talking about cosmology, about being and non-being. They both had meditative practices and yoga. You can imagine Buddhist missionaries coming in and Taoists saying, well, we do it sort of like this, and then they talk back and forth. But you need a common language to do that, which means you need translations. And the first translations just grab the closest Taoist term they can think of. So, for example, for the word dharma, which in Buddhism means the teachings of the Buddha, the word that they get from Chinese is Tao. For nirvana, they translate that as wei, which is non-action or effortless action, even though non-action seems like a very different idea than the liberation from suffering that we call nirvana. For the Sanskrit term for enlightened ones, they translate that as Taoist immortals. For the Sanskrit term for morality, they're going to be more specific, and they just translate it as filial piety and obedience. So they're conversing, but only because Taoists and Buddhists are ignoring a lot of differences between them. Actually, some people wondered if Buddhism was just another form of Taoism. Do you remember that some had thought that when Lao Tzu left China and went to the West, he must have gone to India, where he became known as the Buddha, and now those ideas are coming back to them in a slightly different form. Actually, by the way, in another example, in the standard translation of the Chinese Bible, the opening of the Gospel of John, which you may remember is, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God," when the translators looked at that passage, they had to make a choice as to whether they would translate the word, okay, in Greek it's logos, with a Chinese word that meant word, or whether they would pick a Chinese word that was philosophically loaded in a similar way to the word logos is in Greek. And that's what they went with. So, as I said, the standard Chinese translation, John chapter 1 starts with, "In the beginning was the Tao, and the Tao was with God, and the Tao was God." The influence goes both ways. Religious Taoism, when we talked about Neo-Taoism, is certainly influenced by Buddhist ideas and practices. And then both of those religions are going to compete for state support. The Buddhist conquest of China is a huge topic, with dozens of important figures ranging from monks and scholars to missionaries and merchants and kings. I'm going to focus, however, on one particular individual, a Chinese monk named Xuanzang. His dates are 600 to 664. So this is the time when all of China was once again unified under imperial rule. The Sui dynasty brings it all together in 581, and then that dynasty lasts for about 30 years is all. And then that's followed by the Tang dynasty from 618 to 907. So about 300 years, one of the great glorious times of Chinese culture and art and poetry. Xuanzang was raised in a Confucian family. His older brother was a monk, and he became interested in Buddhism, and eventually he became an initiate himself at the age of 13. He was a very bright boy. It's said that he gave lectures to some of the older monks at that time. But when the Sui dynasty fell, he fled south with his older brother. Later on, Xuanzang described his experiences to one of his disciples that would write a biography of Xuanzang. And this is what he says. At that time, so this is the fall of the Sui dynasty in the turmoil between Sui and Tang. Xuanzang says, "The magistrates were destroyed and monks either perished or took to flight. The streets were filled with bleached bones and the burnt ruins of buildings. At this time, the books of Confucius and the sacred pages of Buddha were forgotten. Everyone was occupied with the arts of war." At the age of 20, Xuanzang became a full monk, and then he went with his brother to the capital of the newly founded Tang dynasty. He started to learn Sanskrit, which is the language of some of these scriptures that are coming in from India, but the multitude of texts and the variety of schools was still very confusing. He came across a partial translation of a text by Vasubandhu's brother, Asanga, on Yogacara Buddhism, remember the consciousness-only school. But there were some missing parts, and Xuanzang thought, if only I could get the whole text, then all of my questions and puzzles and doubts would be resolved. So he decided that he was going to leave China. In 629, so he's 29 years old, he leaves. He doesn't have official permission, and because of border problems at the time, it was illegal for people to leave, but he sneaks out. He makes his way across the Silk Road. He writes later an account of his travels where he talks about dangers on the road from the heat, the desert, from robbers. He finally arrives in India a year later, coming in from Afghanistan in the northwest. Okay. Nobody goes directly from China to India. They have to go around and then down through the northwest because the Himalaya Mountains are there. When he gets to India, Xuanzang discovers that the problems were much bigger than just a few missing chapters for a text. He found that there was a huge tradition of Indian philosophy and lots of competing schools of Buddhism that the Chinese hadn't really heard so much about. During his years in India, he debated other Buddhists and Jain monks and Hindus. He talks about meeting Samkhya and Vaisheshika philosophers. He visited many of the holy sites associated with Buddhism. He spent 2 years studying at Nalanda University. You may remember that institution from Lecture 14. After 16 years abroad, during which time he traveled about 15,000 miles, Xuanzang returned to China with 657 texts, along with several dozen statues and relics. The emperor had heard that he was coming and wanted a personal interview with him. When he saw him, the emperor said, "So why did you leave without permission?" But he continued, "Since you're a monk, then I forgive you. Things are okay." Actually, the emperor did more than forgive him. The emperor sponsored a translation project. He set up Xuanzang in a special monastery. This is the Big Wild Goose Pagoda in Xi'an. If you visit Xi'an today, you can still see this place. And so Xuanzang was there along with 20 assistant translators. And together, they did very accurate translations of over 70 texts. Some of them are quite long. And that took them about 20 years. So these translations aren't just going to use Taoist terms that don't quite fit. They're going to very carefully explain the Sanskrit terms and sometimes invent some new terms to fit these Sanskrit concepts. Students came to study with Xuanzang at this monastery from all over China and even from as far away as Korea and Japan. This was perhaps the largest translation project in Chinese history. There were texts from the Majjhimaka school, texts about Indian logic and Buddhist metaphysics, even a Vaisheshika work, but especially they were interested in Yogacara texts. Now remember, Yogacara Buddhism of Vasubandhu is the newest, most advanced Buddhism at the time. Xuanzang did a translation and then an amalgam of 10 Sanskrit commentaries on Vasubandhu's 30 verses. Actually, incidentally, the emperor also asked Xuanzang to translate the Tao Te Ching from Chinese into Sanskrit, which he did, but apparently that didn't have a great effect in India. Remember, the Darshana Hotel is not all that interested in what's going on out in the Tao Hotel. Xuanzang wrote a travelogue called The Record of Western Lands, and one of his assistant translators wrote a biography of Xuanzang as told by, Xuanzang would tell stories about this, and then later after he was dead, his disciple wrote this biography of him based on his personal recollections. He tells the story of going to Bodh Gaya, which was the site of the Buddha's enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. And this is how this biography explains that event. With the most sincere devotion, Xuanzang cast himself down with his face to the ground, and with much grief and tears, he sighed and said, "At the time when Buddha perfected himself in wisdom, I know not in what condition I was, in the troublous whirl of birth and death. But now, in this lesser age, having come to this spot and reflecting on the depth and weight of the body of my evil deeds, I'm grieved at heart and my eyes filled with tears." Right. This is always the problem with pilgrimages, is you end up at the right site, but you are several hundred years too late to see the event that had caught your attention in the first place. Now Xuanzang knows that at the time the Buddha was enlightened, he was somewhere, maybe not in this world, or maybe as an animal or something, but whatever it was, his sins were such that he wasn't allowed to be right there where the action was really happening. On his deathbed, Xuanzang recited the Heart Sutra, which is a one-page synopsis of a Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. And it has those famous lines, "Form is emptiness, emptiness is form." His translation of the Heart Sutra is still recited throughout East Asia to this day. So Xuanzang is a great mind. He's a traveler, a translator, a philosopher, and a monk. But the Yogacara school wasn't all that appealing in China. They were interested in some different sorts of Buddhism. There are four major schools of Buddhism that become prominent in China. Tiantai, Huayan, that means flower garland, Pure Land, and Chan, or meditation school, or Zen. None of those four schools was particularly important in India. I'll describe each of them and try to keep them in mind because we'll see them again in Lecture 19 when we talk about Japanese Buddhism. Two of the schools focus on doctrine, that's the Tiantai and Huayan, and then two of the schools on practice, and that's Pure Land and Zen. But all of them arise from the same problem. The Chinese didn't know much about the Indian background of Buddhism and its various schools. They just had translations of scriptures, and some of those scriptures contradicted each other, even though each claimed to have come from the Buddha himself. Remember, the definition of a Buddhist sutra is a record of something the Buddha had said. They generally start with the words, "Thus have I heard," and it's thought that Ananda had memorized everything that the Buddha had said. Okay, how are you going to resolve these contradictions? And there's already a model at hand, and it's the Mahayana explanation of Theravada, right? So Theravada Buddhism was the original Buddhism that the Buddha taught to regular people, but there were these higher teachings, secret teachings, that he reserved for his more advanced disciples. Okay, the Chinese have an ideal of harmony through syncretism, of bringing things together. Think about Dongzhongshu and the 100 schools of philosophy and how that comes into what Dongzhongshu does in Han Dynasty Confucianism, bringing together yin yang and the five phases and the teachings of Confucius. So the Chinese idea is the Buddha must have said different things to different audiences depending on their capacity to understand. This is a concept called skillful means, that he'll use whatever it takes to try to get people to the next level of spiritual progress. But of course, they were curious, what's the last word? I mean, what's the Buddha's final truth? Okay, now we go to these four schools. The first is Tiantai, named for the Tiantai Mountain, near the hometown of its founder. And in Japanese, this school is called Tendai. These Tendai Buddhists say that there are different levels of sutras, and the Lotus Sutra is the highest. It's the Lotus Sutra is going to be the most important Buddhist scripture in East Asia. And we'll talk more about that when we talk about Japanese Buddhism. According to Tendai Buddhists, there are three truths: that all things are empty, right? The products of causation with dependent origination. They have no independent nature. Number two, they do, however, have temporary existence. And then the third level of truth is there's a perspective that transcends both of these, sort of a middle way. Buddhists love anything about the middle way. Tendai Buddhists say that all minds are the manifestation of one mind, of absolute reality. And that's the Buddha nature that's in all people and in all things. There are 3,000 realms of existence, and they're all interconnected so that each is present in each. All reality, they say, is immanent in a single instance of thought. If we go to the Huayan school, this is named for the Huayan Sutra, the Flower Garland Sutra. It's similar to Tiantai, but it takes those ideas to another level, actually to the fifth level. So the first level is Theravada, right, that people are products of causation, that there's no self. And then the second level is Mahayana, that everything is emptiness. And then the third level is the higher Mahayana, that emptiness is not inconsistent with the illusion of phenomena. It's like Majjhimaka. And then fourth is the level that's beyond words. And then the fifth and highest is going to be the Flower Garland Sutra, which brings everything together in one absolute reality in which everything has the nature of non-being. Okay. The Huayan Sutra, they said, was actually the first sutra that the Buddha gave right after he became enlightened. But no one understood what he was talking about. So then he started talking about the Four Noble Truths and all of the things that Theravada Buddhists have preserved. According to Huayan Buddhists, every part of the universe reflects and incorporates every other part through interpenetration and through mutual identity of all things. Okay, it's sort of a form of monism. And if you think that's hard to understand, it was hard for the Empress Wu to understand as well. Empress Wu is the only woman in Chinese history who actually rules as an emperor. Okay, now, there were other women who were dowager empresses or who ruled as regents, but Empress Wu in the Tang Dynasty just puts all that aside and says, no, I'm the emperor. There's a monk named Fa Zhang who lives from 643 to 712. He's a prolific author, a great mind in Chinese thought, and he tries to teach this Huayan Buddhism to Empress Wu, and he does so with a couple object lessons. There was a golden lion at court, and he gave a famous sermon on the golden lion. He said the parts of that lion, the hair and the claws and the eyes and so forth, they all exist in relationship to each other, but in the end, it's all gold, right? Gold is the unchanging underlying principle of that statue. It's the Li. We'll talk more about that idea when we talk about Neo-Confucianism. It will be really important principle. And he says that the lion itself is changing phenomena. So the gold is all one substance, but then it can be made in lots of different shapes, including a lion shape. There was another demonstration he made with 10 mirrors. So he set 8 of them in an octagonal pattern, right, about 10 feet across, plus one mirror above and one mirror below. And then he took a small statue of the Buddha and a torch for illumination and put it right in the middle so that you could see the statue of the Buddha in the mirrors. But in the mirrors, you could also see the image of the Buddha in all of the other mirrors as well. And this is a demonstration of how everything is interconnected and mutually identified. Had Vajzang come today, I think he would have liked the idea of holograms. You remember that those are 3D images, so it's like looking through a window almost, and you can sort of see everything behind there. But if you cut up a 3D image, or break it if it's on a sheet of glass, each fragment contains the image of the whole thing. I mean, you can still see the whole thing through it, though it's a little blurry. Okay. He would have loved that. The idea that the Buddha nature is in everything and everyone, and it's the same. So there's a technical word called Tathagata Garbha, the womb of the Buddha. And the idea is that everyone is a Buddha in embryo. Okay? Even if you're not that close now, in some future life, you will become a Buddha. You have that potential within you that will someday blossom and develop. Maybe someday when you're reborn in India. Now, this is an attractive idea to the Chinese because it's rather optimistic. It's something like Mencius's belief that all people have within themselves the capacity to become sages. When Xuanzang went to India, he discovered that the concept of Buddha nature was not part of Indian Buddhism. And then there are lots of arguments between Xuanzang's disciples and Fazang over this key issue, notion, in Chinese Buddhism. This brings us to the third form of Buddhism in China, Pure Land Buddhism. They say that the world is hopelessly corrupt, that enlightenment in this life is impossible. It's just, you just can't learn the truth about it, and you can't put Buddhism into practice the way that you would like to. So your best hope is to be reborn into Amitabha's Western Paradise, or the Pure Land. Amitabha is a bodhisattva who created this land. You can be reborn there, and then you can work on salvation at your own speed, in sort of a more delightful circumstances. There's not a lot of evidence, but some scholars think that there may have been some Zoroastrian influence in the formation of this type of Buddhism in India, and ideas of heaven. This becomes very popular because ordinary people can be Pure Land Buddhists. And it becomes devotional. It's like bhakti yoga, where you chant the name of the bodhisattva Amitabha, or sometimes known as Amida. You say, Namu Amida Butsu, which means praise to Amida Buddha, and hope that he will take you into his Pure Land after you die. The fourth form of Buddhism is Chan Buddhism, a school that focuses on meditation. The word comes from the Sanskrit word jhana, which is transliterated as Chan in Chinese and then transformed into Zen. And we'll just call it Zen, since you may be familiar to that. These Buddhists are against ritual and scholasticism. They talk about a direct transmission of enlightenment from person to person back to the Buddha. So the story is that the Buddha silently held up a flower, and Kashyapa, one of his disciples, smiled at the time, and Buddha realized that Kashyapa had understood that there was a transmission of true enlightenment mind to mind without words. There's a famous poem attributed to Bodhidharma that describes Zen as a special transmission outside the scriptures, no dependence on words and letters, direct pointing at the soul of man, seeing into one's nature to attain Buddhahood. According to legend, Zen was brought to China by the 28th patriarch, Bodhidharma, in the 5th century. So his lineage, spiritual lineage, goes all the way back to the Buddha in 28 jumps. The historical data for Zen Buddhism in China begins in the 7th century with a split over questions about the pace of enlightenment. The northern school, led by Shunshou, said that it was gradual, and the southern school, under Huineng, said that sudden enlightenment was possible. Huineng, he lives from 638 to 713, will win out, and he's probably the most important figure in Chinese Zen. Here's the famous story from the Platform Sutra. The 5th patriarch of Zen knew that he would soon die and decided to determine his successor through a poetry contest, of all things. Because through some verse that someone had written, he could determine the level of the spiritual attainment of the writer. One of his foremost students, Shen Shou, wrote the following poem. The body is the Bodhi tree. Remember, that's the tree that the Buddha was enlightened under. The mind is like a clear mirror. At all times, we must strive to polish it, and we must not let the dust collect. Okay, he was pretty nervous about this, so he wrote the poem anonymously on the wall one night. And the master saw that, and he said, that's all right, but can you do another one? Let me see. At about the same time, there was a young man in the monastery. He wasn't a monk, but he was a kitchen helper, sometimes described as a rice pounder. He had been an illiterate seller of firewood, and then he'd heard a wandering monk talk about the Diamond Sutra. He became interested in Buddhism, actually gained some spiritual progress, and went to live in the monastery. He heard all of this talk about the successor in this poem, and someone read the poem to him. He's still illiterate. And he wrote a rejoinder. And then he had someone write it on the wall, sort of at night, anonymously. And his poem said, Bodhi originally has no tree. The mirror has no stand. Buddha nature is always clean and pure. Where is there room for dust? Right? So you don't have to polish anything. There's nothing to do. You just realize the Buddha nature within. Wei Nung was summoned to a secret interview once the master discovered who had written this poem or who had written the poem and then had somebody else actually write it on the wall. And Wei Nung was given a robe that sort of is the mark of succession. And the master said, you're the one, but no one is going to accept the illiterate kitchen help as the next master of this temple. So you probably should leave right now. So he fled. Now there's a contrast between Confucian-like self-cultivation and Taoist-like sudden transformation. Also, ideas of ineffability, of things can't be put into words, spontaneity, and unconventional teaching methods. Sometimes Zen masters would shout at their students or tweak their nose or use koans, which are these kind of riddles that are intended to jar you out of ordinary ways of thinking. Like one is, if you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha. Whatever that might mean. We'll talk more about that when we come to Japanese Buddhism. But meditation is the crucial method for both the Northern and the Southern schools. Okay, we'll come back to these ideas a little bit later. But before we leave, there's one more famous koan from Wei Nung. The story is that there were two monks watching a flag flapping in the wind. And one monk said, it's the flag that's moving. And the second monk said, no, it's the wind. And Wei Nung came by at the time, and he said, not the flag or the wind, it's your mind that's moving. All right, where to from here? Buddhism was dominant in China in the early Tang Dynasty, but eventually it faded somewhat due to political concerns about monasteries and their political power and the amount of land that they controlled, and monks who didn't pay taxes and didn't provide labor service and didn't serve in the army. There was some government persecution, particularly in the 9th century, and China's loss of control over the Silk Road sort of brought an end to the renewing flow of ideas and scriptures that had been coming in from India. Confucianism will shift to accommodate Buddhist insights. We'll see that in Neo-Confucianism. So there's a decline among the elite, but Buddhism is still very popular among the common people. As an example of its popularity or of popular Buddhism, let's go back to the story of Xuanzang's journey to India. That eventually became one of China's most beloved novels. A writer named Wu Cheng'en published a book in 1529 called Journey to the West, or sometimes the title is translated as Monkey. And in this book, Xuanzang is a monk in search of scriptures. He goes to India, but he's joined by three divine companions, each of whom has been assigned to protect him as penance for past sins. The most famous of these companions is Monkey, who is mischievous and impatient and arrogant, but he's also strong and brave. He has a magical staff and can transform into many forms. Remember when we talked about the Ramayana and the Monkey King who helped out Rama, right? His name was Hanuman. They seem to be related here. So together, these four travelers fight demons and monsters, and they overcome all sorts of obstacles. For example, one adventure, after they finally get to India and they speak to the Buddha himself and they get scriptures from the Buddha, several pack loads worth, they're on their way back home. A big storm comes up and they start to and then they blow around and they see that some of these scrolls are blank. There's nothing on them. And they quickly open up the rest, and they're all blank. There is not a word on any of these scriptures. And so they rush back to the Buddha. They say, what have you done here? And the Buddha says, oh, the true scriptures are indeed wordless. They're beyond words. But if the Chinese are so foolish and unenlightened that they need scriptures with words, well, I can give those to you as well. And he does. Okay, you probably recognize some connections, right? Zen is a form of Buddhism beyond words. Madhyamaka philosophy is everything is emptiness. Journey to the West, and especially the exploits of monkey, are still very popular in China. They're the subject of stories and art and plays and films and even a long-running TV series. The last time that I was in China, I was there with my 12-year-old son, and there was a cartoon version that we enjoyed together. It seemed like it was on TV all the time. In many ways, the subject of this lecture is transformation. An Indian religion becomes a Chinese faith. Sanskrit scriptures become Chinese texts, and a historical pilgrimage becomes a work of fiction. Let me give you two more quick transformations. The Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, who's known as Guanyin in the Lotus Sutra, goes from being male in India to being female in China. Remember, gender is an eternal thing. And the Maitreya Buddha, the Buddha who's going to come at the end of time and restore Buddhism and bring in a new age, he becomes the happy, fat Buddha, sometimes known as the laughing Buddha, that you may have seen in Chinese restaurants or such. That form comes when he was incarnated as a Zen monk of the 10th century named Budai, who was sort of round and cheerful, and he had candy that he used to give out to children. Now, that fat, happy monk may seem like the opposite of all life is suffering, but perhaps it's a better fit for Chinese culture. We'll see lots of transformations of all kinds through the rest of the lectures in this series.